for Mr. Hutchinson, and opposing counsel called, you ought to be here soon.
Very well. We'll take that case second unless counsel doesn't appear timely. These cases are set for 15 minutes per side. You'll be guided by a lighting system at the podium, which works as follows. When your time begins, the green light comes on. When 10 minutes have expired, the amber light will come on. And when your full 15 minutes have expired, the red light will come on. The podium also has a clock that counts backwards from 15, so you'll know how much time you have remaining in your argument. Please feel free to adjust the podium up and down, depending upon your needs. We do ask that you stay close to the podium, please, because we're recording your arguments. We sometimes find it helpful to go back and listen to them again. And if you stray from the podium, your voice will not be picked up by the recording device. We've read the briefs in your cases. We're familiar with the facts as you set them forth. So to the extent you wish to proceed directly to the legal argument, that's fine with us. Nonetheless, the case is yours to argue as you wish. We would ask anyone in the audience or counsel who have a cell phone, please ensure it's turned off at this time, or any other kind of device that could interrupt the argument. We're ready for argument.
May it please the court, opposing counsel, my name is Peter Bornstein. I represent Professor Dean Taylor, the plaintiff below and the appellant before this court. And I do intend to try to use this clock to reserve some time for myself for a rebuttal. While the issue of an award of nominal damages is here now on appeal, that issue was not present in the trial court below. The main issue in the trial court below was whether there was an implied term in the contract allowing Mr. Taylor to get notice that the demolition was going to begin and give him an opportunity to get his fixtures out of the condominium unit. The secondary issue below related to how to measure damages, not the evidence of damages. And so below, the defendant did not challenge the Home Depot exhibits or Taylor's oral testimony that the cost to replace the fixtures was $55,000. And the defendant did not put on any evidence of their own as to any alternative numbers of damages or any alternative evidence of, say, what the fixtures looked like at demolition, whether they had been damaged in some form when Mr. Taylor was not occupying the condominium unit for approximately a year before demolition, etc. What they argued below as far as damages were concerned was that the fixtures had no real value because they were old and depreciated, some 12 years old. They argued about the cost to haul them down to Denver, and they argued about the fact that Mr. Taylor, Professor Taylor, didn't know what had happened to the fixtures in the year that he wasn't occupying the apartment or the condominium. So it was before the court whether replacement value was a proper measure of damages or whether depreciated market value was the proper measure of damages. Now, the trial court just didn't address the issue. As the court has seen, we quoted pretty much every word that the trial court said on how the court said why there was going to be nominal damages.
And Borstein, is it your position that the court had to choose one or the other and didn't specifically say so in the findings?
It's my position that, yes, the court needed to say how it was going to handle the damage issue when the parties presented two alternative measures. Now, I suppose a trial court could find a third if on its own if it so wanted to choose to, but it didn't choose to do that. Instead, the court didn't address that issue and seemed to just say Mr. Taylor had some kind of fault at issue because he did not keep on top of what was going on in Vail, and therefore he was just going to get nominal damages. And so the court neither chose between the two kinds of issues, or two opposing forms that the parties gave to the court, nor did the court come up with a third one.
Well, is it your view that the court needed to choose only one, and that the choice would be an appropriate discretionary determination, or that there is indeed only one measure of damages applicable here?
It's my contention here that only replacement cost was the proper measure of damages. And so if the court had chosen the market value, we would still be before the Court of Appeals saying that the court made the wrong legal choice.
Can't you imply or infer that he was choosing a depreciated measure based on the findings?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe that the court made any findings that the there was no value because it had depreciated to zero.
Well, he said there was no evidence of the condition at demolition, didn't he? Something to that effect?
Something to that effect.
Which sounds like a depreciated measure.
Well, I guess if you tortured it a little bit, you could reach that conclusion, but I would urge this court not to torture it that way. So that now before this court, the issue of whether the evidence should have come in was not an issue before the court, and the court allowed the evidence in without reservation, without objection, and so it needed to at least address that. It needed to say if it wasn't going to give that evidence any weight at all, which we would say it couldn't do that because nobody challenged that the Home Depot values were real. Nobody challenged that the Home Depot values weren't valid. And nobody challenged that the Home Depot values didn't represent a reasonable replacement cost method of determining what the replacement cost was. So,
well, in a replacement cost analysis, wouldn't it be correct to say that if you use replacement cost, nonetheless, there has to be some depreciation from the replacement value itself, because otherwise you're getting brand new fixtures. And what you bargained for was used fixtures.
What, as we pointed out in our brief, what we bargained for was not having to go into the market and buy new fixtures. What we bargained for was to avoid buying new fixtures. And so in order to get the benefit of that bargain, we had to have the fixtures itself.
Wouldn't it be unjust enrichment to your client if he got $55,000 and put in brand new fixtures when in fact what he bargained for was 12-year-old fixtures?
I'm disagreeing with the way the court's analyzing that issue, because we are clearly saying that what was bargained for was the opportunity to not have to go and buy new fixtures. So Mr. Taylor was saying, if I have to go buy $55,000 worth of fixtures, instead of that, I will bargain with Mr. Noble and get my own fixtures, pay whatever costs I have to remove them, put them in a truck, take them down to Denver, put them in, whatever that cost may be. But I get those. I do not have to buy new fixtures. What Mr. Taylor then had to do was to buy new fixtures. So his damages are the fact that he had to go out and buy new fixtures. The second issue before the court would be mooted if the court goes our way in the issue of the fact of the judge not applying the correct standard of law on damages, and instead, and we would assert that the nominal damages of $10 was not rationally based on depreciation or the cost to remove the fixtures or the fact that they were 12 years old. The $10 is an arbitrary and capricious number that's solely based, at least according, I mean, it's not based on any evidence other than the fact that there was a $10 per year rental fee to rent the entire condominium unit during the interim period between when it was bought and when it was going to be demolished. But that issue, if it's decided the way we ask this court to decide it, moots the issue of the attorney fees. But I just want to spend just a minute to address the issue raised now in the briefs before this court as to whether there is some confusion in the law with respect to the mixture between Rule 54D costs and how to determine who is the prevailing party and the amount of discretion awarded to trial courts to determine 54D costs and prevailing parties, and fee-shifting provisions in contracts that have less discretion, and that if there is any award or determination of liability, that fee-shifting provisions in contracts should be honored by the trial court entirely, and the court should make a determination that the party that won the issue of liability does get its attorney fees and costs, and that 54D is not the law that governs in that case.
Is it your view that the trial court does or does not have discretion to make the determination of who's the prevailing party?
It's my view that under 54D, the trial courts do have that discretion, but that discretion is severely limited if it's a fee-shifting provision in a contract.
Still have to decide who the prevailing party was, though, do they not?
They certainly have to decide who the prevailing party is, and certainly if this case was a multi-claim, where there was a mixture of contract claims and statutory claims like disability or discrimination claims, it could be a difficult call. I concede that. If there's counterclaims or third-party claims, and some are lost and some are won and some are partially won and some are approximate, yes, that could be a difficult call, and the trial court, yes, would have to make that determination. But this case was simple, and so that determination, that kind of complicated analysis, was not appropriate to the simple facts of this case, in which the main issue was there an implied term in the contract, either through the law of good faith or from just an implied the law of contracts, that he was entitled to notice and an opportunity to get his fixtures out of the unit.
Mr. Bornstein, I know you're wanting to reserve some time, but I do want to, either now or in your rebuttal, I'd like to have this question answered. Assuming if the court were to determine that the trial court erred in determining the measure of damages, why would we not be remanding for the trial court to make a new ruling? Why would it, you're requesting that we just say 55 and that's it. Why wouldn't we not remand?
Because the record's clean. That's the only reason. The record's clean. There was a full opportunity to litigate the issue. The parties put whatever evidence they wanted before the court, and it was unrebutted that replacement value was $55,000. The only issue was that the right measure of damages?
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ryan Smith, opposing counsel. It's my colleague, Reed Wiley, at the table with me. Now, I'm representing appellees Peter Noble and Crossroads 2E. With the court's permission, I will jump right into the arguments, beginning with damages and then turn next to attorney's fees. Your Honors, plaintiff in this case is asking you to second-guess the trier of facts determinations related to the credibility, sufficiency, and weight of the evidence. Now, this court is empowered to affirm those factual determinations of the trial court, namely that plaintiff failed to present any evidence of the value of the fixtures for several reasons. First, we contend that the conclusions of a trial court related to the sufficiency, credibility, and weight of the evidence are disturbed only on appeal if clearly erroneous. Now, as Judge Furman alluded to earlier, the trial case in this course concluded that the plaintiff presented no evidence of the value of the fixtures. Specifically, after hearing all the evidence presented by plaintiff, the court explained, I quote, "I don't know when the fixtures went in. I don't know what quality they were. I don't know what condition was when plaintiff left. I don't know if that condition bore any relationship whatsoever to what the condition was a year later," unquote. Therefore, Your Honor, the court's conclusions related to the evidence went directly to the sufficiency of the evidence, or in this case, the lack thereof.
And if replacement cost is the right measure of damages, though, that wouldn't preclude an award, would it? Because you don't have to present evidence of what the actual value of the fixtures was.
Your Honor, I would contend that even under replacement cost, replacement cost applies, does not relieve the plaintiff of his evidentiary burden of proving what the replacement cost of those fixtures were.
Well, but the trial court's comments, as you just related, talked about the value of the fixtures before the demolition. I didn't see anything in the trial court's findings, unless you can point something to me, that says he didn't present any evidence on replacement cost.
You're right, Your Honor. The court simply said he did not present any evidence of the value of the fixtures, as you alluded to earlier, Your Honors, that referred to that one could infer from that the court did imply a market value approach.
So you're saying that's more of a depreciation approach
that the court applied?
Yes.
Judge, the court didn't expressly apply any.
Well, that's an issue, isn't it?
Didn't expressly provide any replacement cost, but it's our contention, or any measure of damage.
I mean, the Home Depot costs, let me back up. You don't dispute that replacement cost is a valid measure of damages.
We don't dispute the replacement cost is a valid measure of damages in certain cases. I don't know that that was the case.
But here, if there was no notice, we're going to destroy, we're going to demolish, how could the person know what condition these items were in?
Well, Your Honor, the person, you're correct, the plaintiff below would not have known what condition that they were in prior to the demolition. However, what he did have the burden of showing is that despite the condition, he had to show what the fixtures were in the first place.
He testified as to what they were.
That's right.
There's no question about that.
That's right. The plaintiff did, in fact, testify. However, the court...
And he said, I described that to the Home Depot estimators, and this is how they came up with these numbers. To say there was no evidence, there was evidence of a value.
You're right, Your Honor. We contend that the evidence was not credible, and the judge weighed the testimony, the plaintiff's own lay opinion testimony, the plaintiff's expert testimony, and the Home Depot estimate, and found that it bore no relationship to the value of the fixtures. He didn't know what the brand, the make, the model, or any of those were, the dimensions of the countertops, the all kinds of things that would be important for a Home Depot estimator to know when.
Wasn't Exhibit 12 a picture of one of the countertops, for example?
Your Honor, yes, the plaintiff...
I mean, it's a picture with diagrams. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe that's not an accurate picture,
right,
but
that
it
picture
seemed...
may certainly depict dimensions of countertops, but countertops are only one element here.
Well, I'm just using that as an example.
Yes, and
you're saying there's no evidence, and I'm having a hard time understanding if he said this is what was in it when I was there.
Okay. Your Honor, as you may recall from the record, the 2 years, a year elapsed since he was last in the condo. So we don't know what happened to the fixtures during that time that the plaintiff was absent from the condo.
Well, isn't there an inference that nothing happened to them? Because he rented out the unit for another year without making any capital improvements whatsoever.
That's right, Your Honor. But the condition of the appliances and countertops could have certainly deteriorated over that year. And so
how does that go to a replacement measure of damages?
Your Honor, it does not go to the replacement measure of damages. We're not contending that the replacement cost measure was the appropriate measure of damages. It could have been the market value. Replacement cost is certainly the appropriate measure where there is no market value for the fixtures.
But was there any evidence of what the market value was? Was there any evidence presented?
No, there was no evidence presented of the market value. There was no evidence presented of the value by any measure, whether it be market value, replacement cost, or otherwise.
There was replacement cost evidence. I'm having a hard time understanding your statement.
No, I'm sorry. You're correct. The plaintiff did present evidence of replacement cost. It's just that the trial court, as the finder of fact, determined that that bore no relationship to what may have actually been in the condo, did not believe the credibility of the evidence presented by plaintiff.
So what I'm trying to find out is, did your client put on any contradictory evidence of what the value would be or what the damages could be?
Your Honor, I don't believe that my client did. However, the a court, as you know, may make determinations even in the absence of evidence proffered by the defendant. It was the plaintiff's burden in this case to prove the value of the fixtures, and the plaintiff wholly failed to do so, as the trial court found.
The trial court said, I don't find any of this credible. I would tend to agree with you, but I don't find anything in the trial court's findings in which he comments.
You're right, Your Honor. The trial court did not use the word credible. It rather found that there was no evidence of the value of the fixtures, and then explained why the evidence that was presented was, in fact, insufficient to support an award of damages.
He's not making a call on the replacement value. He's making a call on the value at the time of the demolition.
Your Honor, you're right. It's unclear from the record which method he applied. You can certainly infer that he replied the market value. However, we contend that the court need not even have applied one particular measure of damages, because the plaintiff failed to present any measure any evidence related to the value of the fixtures that would be relevant in any determination of damages, whether it be replacement cost, market value, or otherwise.
I'm really having trouble figuring out why you're saying the plaintiff didn't present any evidence of replacement value when he did.
Well, Your Honor, he did present it. When I say he doesn't present any evidence, I suppose I'm quoting the trial court, the record there. And while he did present
to me why the trial court's ruling is not erroneous then.
Because the trial court was in the best position to weigh the credibility and weight and the sufficiency of the evidence that was presented. And it was not clearly erroneous, because the trial court heard all the evidence. It heard the Home Depot estimate. It admitted it into evidence. It heard the plaintiff's testimony. It just didn't, the trial court didn't believe that that testimony supported the award of damage that they requested. So it was not clear, because it's supported, you know, by the record. The evidence presented was insufficient. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
Well, here's what the judge found. So now what I have to determine is, what is the value of the right to remove fixtures? All the evidence that was admitted in regard to Home Depot is hearsay. Those are out-of-court statements as to value that bears no relationship to the right to remove fixtures. All you were entitled to, Mr. Taylor, were fixtures. I don't know what the condition was when you left. The condition you left may bear no relationship whatsoever to what the condition was a year later. So I don't, if it's replacement, I don't see how he's making any credibility findings. I think he's saying, I don't have any evidence of your right to remove fixtures, whatever condition they were in.
That's correct, Your Honor. The court found that there was no evidence of the value of the fixtures.
Mr. Wiley, do you agree that the trial court made a finding, implicit perhaps, that your client breached a contract with the plaintiff?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were addressing Mr. Wiley. Mr. Smith.
Mr. Smith, I'm sorry, Mr. Smith.
Can you kindly repeat the question for
me? I apologize. Are we clear that the trial court made a finding that your client breached the contract?
Your Honor, the court never clearly announced it in terms of a breach, but the court did nonetheless find that that we had an obligation and that we failed to meet that obligation.
Which is a breach, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. In the very same breath, however, that the court found that we, as the defendant, had an obligation, the trial court found that plaintiff had an equal obligation to not just sit idly back while the fixtures were destroyed. So therefore, it's our contention that if we both had equal obligations and we were to have been in breach, the plaintiff also failed to fulfill his obligation, therefore he would have also been in breach.
That pleaded in?
Sorry.
Was plaintiff's alleged breach of the contract pleaded in the answer as
Your Honor,
a defense?
We did contend that both parties prevailed in part on the question of liability. That's the argument that I'm making.
My question, though, relates to your argument. Did you contend, did your client contend in trial court?
Oh. No, Your Honor. In the trial court, we did not allege any breach on behalf of plaintiff.
And we've got one claim on which the trial court predicated liability, which is breach of contract. And if there's no contention that the plaintiff himself breached it, why is that finding even at all relevant? Because the other claims, the conversion claim, the implied duty of good faith, the court found those weren't proved. So the only thing he found was proved was this contract right of notification. So how does the plaintiff's conduct relate to the breach of contract determination?
Your Honor, it relates to it insofar as the court found that both parties were responsible for the destruction of the fixtures. We had an obligation. They had an obligation. Neither party lived up to their obligation. So we contend that both parties were responsible for the loss of the fixtures.
But the court made no
That's correct, Your Honor. We as the defendant did not counterclaim for breach of contract. It was an implied term. So, Your Honor, one way that we've alluded to already is that the court can find that neither party prevailed under the holding in Wheeler is that both parties prevailed in part on the question of liability. That is one of our arguments, that both parties did in fact prevail in part on the question of liability insofar as both were responsible for the loss of the fixtures.
But I recognize that that's your contention, but I don't see, since only one of the parties actually had a claim against the other, then you didn't prevail on anything. If you didn't have a counterclaim, then you didn't prevail on anything.
That's correct, Your Honor. The Supreme Court, Colorado Supreme Court, in the case of Archer v. Farmer Brothers, held that a party need not prevail on, let alone even bring a counterclaim, in order to be determined a prevailing party. And then the other alternative under which we argue that we won and the court did not abuse its discretion, or rather that the plaintiff did not wholly prevail, is that we did in fact win on a 2 out of 3 claims. We won on the first claim, which was for conversion, and the second claim, which was for breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing. So in essence, defendant won on 2 out of 3 claims. Courts have recognized in multiple...
They're all the same claim, aren't they? They're just 3 different ways to plead it.
Your Honor, in the pleadings, the plaintiff pled three different claims in the pleadings.
And all of which had the same damages, correct?
Yes, I believe the same damages would in fact be the same. However, they were pled on different theories, one for conversion and 2 alleged under breach of contract. So the plaintiff did in fact raise different theories of liability.
So you're saying any time a plaintiff pleads alternative theories, it should be penalized for doing so because it prevails on only one and not all 3?
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far. I'd say that I'm aware of no case that has said that just because the claims are allegedly pled in the alternative means that it removes them from the purview of a multi-claim case, wherein the trial court has discretion to award fees to either party or neither party, even in the case of a breach of a contract.
Your rule would be a disincentive to plead alternative claims, wouldn't it?
You're correct, Your Honor. I don't contend that that is a hard and fast rule by any measure. I just simply contend that under the facts of this case, we prevailed on 2 claims and the plaintiff prevailed on 1. And in the alternative, that we both prevailed in part on the question of liability and who is responsible for the loss of the fixtures.
By saying plaintiff prevailed on 1, you're agreeing that plaintiff prevailed on the breach of contract claim.
Because
I had understood your answer to that question was not quite as clear.
I should say that we believe the plaintiff certainly did prevail, but only in part. And that's due to the court's findings that the plaintiff also breached an obligation to the defendant, which was not to sit back idly by while the fixtures are destroyed and afterwards say, aha, I gotcha. So, Your Honors, I think we've had a good discussion on the issues. I will just briefly conclude here. I'm out of time. Your Honor, we ask that the court uphold the decision of the court below. Thank you.
The first issue that I want to address is a practical issue.
Having tried the case in the trial court, I can explain to this court that the practicalities facing Professor Taylor in trying to determine, trying to present a case as to what his damages were such that there was no practical way he could put on any evidence of what the fixtures looked like during the year that he wasn't in the unit, because he wasn't didn't have access to it. It had been rented to somebody else. He wasn't given notice, so he couldn't go and examine the fixtures before demolition began. And had this need to put fixtures in his Denver unit at some point. So the only measure of damages that he could present evidence regarding is replacement cost as a practical matter. As a practical matter, that other evidence perhaps could be developed by taking depositions of opposing party and seeing if they would be willing to provide the evidence as to what the fixtures were like and what the condition they were in. On the other hand, the opposing party may not have even known what those conditions were themselves.
How about calling the tenant who rented the unit for the 1 year following his?
I suppose that if we could find that, first we would have to identify the tenant, because we weren't privy to that person's name and address, and then try to locate them. Perhaps the defendant would know where they had moved to when the building was demolished, maybe not. Theoretically, yes, we could probably have tried to track that down. It may have been a rabbit hole rather than real evidence. But in any event, it was a choice based on the practicalities and the facts at hand, and Professor Taylor's needs and what he bargained for, that determined the strategy that we put on of only putting on evidence of replacement cost and trying to argue that that was the proper measure of damages. Now, there was, the answer to my other question is, there was no pleading saying that Professor Taylor was somehow either had some implied obligation of his own under the contract terms, or that he had some negligence concept facing him if he didn't keep on top of what was going on in Vail. So there was no counter pleading, either as an affirmative defense or as a counterclaim. And there were no arguments that there was an implied term. The argument made by the defense was there were no implied terms. He had no right to notice, period. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course. As soon as counsel can set up and be